So Allison gave the disclaimer that her voice carries, so I feel like I need to give the disclaimer that my voice is missing. So please bear with me, and I apologize. But I come to this work and this interest in agriculture from my passion in creating healthier food and activity environments for all people in all communities to help prevent chronic disease. And before I came to Prevention Institute, I actually ran a youth development program for kids, for teenagers that were doing a project in their community around healthy eating and physical activity. And they could design whatever project they wanted. And the thing that they decided to do was work with the summertime rec departments to develop like a health carnival at the different rec centers to teach kids healthy behaviors. So all summer they were running around talking to nutritionists and to doctors and gathering all this information about how to make learning about healthy eating and activity fun. And one day we were having a conversation and one of the youth who was a recent immigrant from Vietnam raised her hand and said, "How come in my country the poor people eat fruits and vegetables? And in this country, the poor people can't afford fruits and vegetables." And that was a huge aha moment for these kids because, you know, they were so concerned with getting the young kids that they would be working with appropriate health messages. And this really led to a discussion about how our environment and particularly policy can impact whether or not people can adopt those messages we're trying to get them to adopt. And it really led them to say, well, what can we do about this sort of thing? And I bring that up because I think we as public health professionals often ask that same question, what can we do? And that is actually the reason why we at Prevention Institute developed the Environmental Nutrition and Activity Community Tool. In California, we staff a statewide coalition called the Strategic Alliance, which advocates and works with communities to create healthier food and activity environments. And recently, with funding from the Kellogg Foundation, we are able to enhance the tool to reflect the broader concerns about health and how a more sustainable food system can address that. So I'm going to get to the tool in a minute, but first I wanted to share this message from the book, The Hungry Planet. Has anyone here seen the book, The Hungry Planet? It's a great book, and for those of you who haven't, I highly recommend it. It goes, it depicts images from across the world and what families eat in a week's time. And this is a family, I believe, from Ecuador, and it's a huge juxtaposition to see the foods that they eat compared to the family from my neck of the woods, Napa, California, and the foods that they eat. And you'll notice, you know, there's just here you don't see a single box or anything like that, and here it's almost all packaged, processed foods. And so certainly this family may benefit from some health messages about how to ensure a healthier, more sustainable diet, but if those foods aren't accessible, if it's not affordable, they're not going to be able to adopt those practices. And in fact, it is unreasonable to expect that people will change their behavior easily when there are so many forces in the social, cultural, and physical environment that conspire against such change. And when we talk about the environment, I think it's important to talk about the entire food system, and how everything from how between the time it's a little seed on the farm to when that food reaches our plate, how those processes and the policies that shape those processes can impact us. And we, in 2005, did a report, Cultivating Common Ground, Linking Health and Sustainable Agriculture, which really helped, you know, looked at sort of the different paradigms in which people working from health and particularly nutrition standpoint and those coming to this from an environmental perspective are looking at this issue and helped to make the case for people working in public health nutrition as to why what are the broader impacts of our food system. And I'm not going to go into this because my colleagues before me did such a good job outlining the current impacts of our health, of our food system. But one thing I do want to point out is that this is also an issue of health disparities. Because when we're talking about farm workers and those working in production, they're often in the most dangerous positions. They are often the most food insecure people in our society, ironically. And also, the air quality impacts farm working communities, but also when that food travels 1,500 to 2,400 miles down our nation's freeways in diesel trucks, it's oftentimes low-income urban communities that live close to the freeways that are most impacted. So as I said, we developed the Environmental Nutrition Activity Tool to give people working in public health achievable strategies that they could work on at the local level to improve food and activity environments. And this is the homepage for Enact, and you'll see it's divided into seven environments: childcare, school, and after school, community, workplace, healthcare, and government. So if we clicked into one of those, if we clicked into childcare, here's the list of strategies that that we developed through extensive research on both evidence-based and also community wisdom. Because as we know, environmental change policies and organizational practices to support health, this is a much newer field. There is some evidence base emerging. But, you know, there's also things that community residents, community activists have known for years work to improve our food and activity environments. And through our most recent process of enhancing the tool, or I should also say, originally when we developed the tool, we then vetted the strategies with a national advisory group. And more recently, when we updated the tool with the new sustainable food system strategies, we talked to experts across the country to really identify what were some promising policies. So just to give you a flavor, I'm going to mix things up, click on the first strategy, which is a physical activity strategy. So you can see what one of the pages look like. Each page has a range of tools to help guide implementation. So there's a description of what that strategy means and characteristics of what that looks like if it were in place. And as you scroll down the page, there's case studies, organizations and coalitions that are actively engaged. So if you wanted to really link with them, evidence-based and policies, which links to our local policy database, which I'll mention in a minute. And then also, I'm going to click back for a minute because you may have noticed that on the left side, there's a place where you can prioritize if this is a high, medium, or low strategy, and then also the current status, where this currently, whether this has either not been implemented at all in your community or fully implemented. And that's because Enact has an interactive feature where if you're part of a coalition or an organization, you can get everyone to sign on and fill out an Enact assessment, and Enact will compile your results. And then that's a way to have a starting point conversation about, well, where do we go from here? What do we work on first? I'm going to click back to the main page because you'll notice the cute little icon on the right that says New Sustainable Food System Strategies. So our sustainable food system strategies are integrated throughout the tool. So if you click on any of the environments, you'll see them there. But we also wanted to put them, you know, really up front in one place because oftentimes the people coming to this tool are coming from, you know, a concern for nutrition. And we really want to make the case for people who care about nutrition about the broader impacts and what, you know, how these strategies can also impact health and nutrition. So at the top of the page, when you click on that icon, it gives a little bit of, you know, making the case why this is important. And then as you scroll down, it goes through all the strategies linked to sustainable food systems. So community strategies, workplace strategies, healthcare strategies, and government strategies. Now, I notice you all look like you want to jump up and run to the nearest computer lab, but there's question and answers at the end, and I want to give everyone time to answer questions. So I thought I would give everyone a sneak peek of some of the things you might find in the tool, and then you can, after at 10 o'clock, you're welcome to go visit the nearest Wi-Fi hotspot. So I'll give you that in a minute, but I also wanted to share with you, I mentioned the Enact Local Policy Database, which really people came to us and said, okay, we care about an environmental approach, we want to make this happen, but we need some more tools to really help us implement policies at the local level. So the database houses policies passed by cities, counties, school districts, special districts, and boards of health. And so advocates can look at what other communities have done rather than starting from scratch and say, you know, would this work here, or bring it to an elected official and say, hey, this is what, you know, Woodbury, Iowa did? Could we do this in our community? So we can even search by sustainable agriculture, either in the simple search feature, or you'll see there's some more guided searches, search functions at the bottom. And if we search by sustainable agriculture, it brings up a list of policies. And I'm going to click on the third one, which is the City of Madison Comprehensive Plan, which promotes the sale of locally grown food, development of community gardens, protection of agriculture and open spaces, and the provision of extensive pedestrian and bicycle routes. So if you click on that, you then are brought, you get brought to a profile which has some basic information at the top about the policy, a synopsis and a description that sort of bullets out the different elements of the policy. And then also we've written a health implication section so that, you know, some of them it's very clear what the links to health are, but for those that aren't, you can read about, you know, what we think the health implications are and use that to make the case with the decision makers in your community. If you were to continue to scroll down, the part that I think is the coolest about the database is that it links to the actual policy language. So you can click on the policy language and really, you know, again, use from what other communities have already done. And where possible, we've also included a contact person that you can follow up directly with. So here's where I'm going to give you a few examples of some of the things you might find in the database. One thing that you can find in almost every single one of our the seven environments I mentioned is developing policies that include nutrition, health, and environmental standards. There's a real trend right now in places like schools and hospitals developing nutrition standards for their food purchasing. But this is also an opportunity to think broader about other health and environmental concerns. And this picture is actually from a hospital that we work with as part of the Healthcare Without Harm initiative, John Muir Hospital, that has really done a phenomenal job engaging all different stakeholders within the hospital to adopt a food policy, and they've made some really great changes to both cafeteria and patient meals. And here's a picture of their executive chef, Allison Negrin, hard at work. Also investing in processing and distribution infrastructure. Again, something that my colleagues have highlighted, and when we spoke with experts, this is one that emerged as one of the most important strategies, particularly as institutions like hospitals and schools are interested in purchasing from local farms, but there oftentimes isn't that distribution and infrastructure in place. You know, when schools say, well, we want apples, but, you know, we need 800 apples, and, you know, Farmer John can't provide 800 apples, or we want vegetables, but we need them cut up and put into little baggies or the kids won't eat them. So light processing infrastructure. And this actually, farmer is Juan Perez from the Central Valley in California, and he's part of ALBA, which stands for Agriculture Land-Based Training Association, which sort of acts as that distributor to make sure that the food grown by former farm workers, who they're also providing training and technical assistance and land to farm their own land, and then getting that food from those farms to institutions like schools, universities, hospitals, etc. Supporting farmland conservation. Farmland is being lost at an alarming rate at this in this country, and while there's certainly some federal and state policies can help, local policies and local government can help to ensure that farmland is protected. Investing in new and existing farmers, again, you know, that's another really important strategy. As farmers are aging out of the profession, new farmers aren't necessarily going into the profession. And there's a real opportunity to invest in those who are small and mid-sized farmers, and particularly minority farmers. And supporting urban agriculture, making sure that people have access to food in their communities, that they're learning about the process of how food is grown, and really creating those connections between people perhaps living in more urban environments, between where their food comes from and how it gets to their plate. And then lastly, establishing farmers markets. This is obviously something that fits into the community environment on an act, but also a lot of institutions such as healthcare, government, are sponsoring farmers market, which on their facilities, which end up being a benefit for staff, but also for visitors and guests as well, and the surrounding community. So to end, I also wanted to say that with the recent farm bill, there was some opportunity at the federal level, but that, you know, we as public health professionals have an opportunity at the local level to really impact policy. And also, we're all part of organizations. So changing our organizational practices to reflect the values that are most important to us. So please don't expect politicians, even good ones, to do your job for you. Politicians are like weather vanes, and our job is to make the wind blow. So I invite you to visit Enact on our website and also the local policy database. Also, Cultivating Common Ground, the report I reference, is also available for free on our website. And for those interested, we're also at the Josie Bass booth. We're selling our textbook, Prevention is Primary, which includes a chapter on creating healthier food environments written by Leslie Mickelson, Catherine Erickson, and Marion Nessel. And then the last thing I have to say is that, you know, with our recent financial crisis and food crisis, there's a lot of talk going on about stimulating the economy and reinvesting in Main Street. And this, at Prevention Institute, we feel that this is a really important opportunity to highlight the importance of health and investing in prevention in terms of ensuring the health of our communities and of our workforce. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be developing some materials to really highlight strategies such as sustainable agriculture, green jobs, and how those can be a part of any investment in our economy. So I invite you to visit our booth at 1014 to sign on, or if you prefer to give me a business card, I'll make sure you get updated information about that. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a great presentation and a really valuable tool. I know there will be a run on the Wi-Fi systems out there. That was really this has been a terrific panel. I think it was interesting when we looked at the list of sessions because they were very disparate topics within the area of industrial agriculture. But I think that they're all carrying a common message about some of the harms that are going on and bringing forth ideas and ways that we in public health can engage to build towards more sustainable forms of agriculture. So we had presentations on animal agriculture and antibiotic resistance, peak oil and public health's role, community food system assessment, and this tool for communities to build towards more sustainable food systems. And at this point, we'd like to open it up to questions. We've got about 10 minutes.
Well, I like your question, but I probably won't answer it directly. But I do want to, first of all, point out that some of the cattle byproducts are fed to chickens first, and then the chicken litter is fed back to the cattle, and vice versa. So it's what you're pointing out, though, is that one needs to think about all of these animal environments, including the feed, as part of a broader ecosystem. And yet we're not being very smart in terms of our practices, in terms of how we dispose of the animal waste, i.e. circulating it back into the animal feed, not smart. Just the feed itself. The feed industry is a pretty opaque box, so it's hard to know exactly what some of the practices are. a lot of the information, again, like antibiotic use or arsenic use in animal feed, it's not, we don't know the extent of certain practices because it's not reported anywhere and the information's not collected. So what I would take away from your question is just that we need a much more ecological and health-oriented approach to these things, so that maybe the upstream question is, what would be the healthy practice that we want to promote instead of, let's just keep doing what we've always been doing and try not to worry about what the health implications are, which is where we are right now. Yeah, that's a good and kind of a complex question. Both John and I work with a group called KeepAntibioticsWorking.org. So this is a coalition of public health, environmental, agriculture, and other groups working specifically in the question of how do we limit or phase out unnecessary uses of antibiotics in agriculture to preserve antibiotics so that they'll be effective for humans. And some of that information is actually in the display area at the Union of Concerned Scientists booth, which is booth 2000, or you can just go to the website, which is keepantibioticsworking.org. For several years, we've been supporting a federal bill called PAMTA, the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act. And that bill, which has a fair amount of support in both the House and the Senate, would phase out the use of seven classes of medically important antibiotics or human antibiotics for use in animal feed. So we think that would be a good start. But more broadly, everything involving food and agriculture is a potential vehicle for making improvements for public health with respect to how agriculture is done. So the Farm Bill certainly is an opportunity. I think we're already looking forward to the next Farm Bill in 2012 and how we can build in healthier practices in that. This year, the Child Nutrition Act is going to be reauthorized. And so many in this community and the broader public health community are thinking, well, gee, when we look at WIC or school lunch programs, what policies can we promote as public health professionals that will make that link between food for children and how that food's produced so that it's produced in a healthier way? Yeah, John?
No one introduced FDA guidance 1 to 2. There is an agency
An agency, FDA has a strategy for addressing some of the antibiotics issues called Guidance 152. I would have to say, though, that it's largely been applied to date for new drugs that companies are seeking to get approval for. It's not been applied for all the antibiotics currently approved and on the market. And FDA does not have a terribly strong authority to take products off the market once they've been approved. So, you know, science progresses and we learn more, so sometimes that's a real barrier as we learn more and then wish we hadn't approved something 30 years ago. It turns out to be awfully difficult to get off the market. And Ronnie, did you want to say anything about NANA or any of that?
I'd rather get more questions right in because we only have another couple minutes. Right. So no, that's fine. It's good.
Well, First of all, I want to be clear that the broader environmental problem with using antibiotics routinely in agriculture is not residues in food. It's the resistant bugs on the food. And those resistant bacteria are also in the broader environment because of the agricultural practices. But to speak to your question, when antibiotics are used in the food animals or in agriculture in general, there's generally a withdrawal time, so they stop using them just before the product goes to market. And so that's particularly an issue with dairy designed to keep antibiotic residues out of dairy products. So I don't really know of much the in terms of the residues beyond what you're talking about. No, and that's the problem, because resistance is an ecological problem, and it's not a residue problem. It's a problem that once you create an environment where the presence of antibiotics is routine, you're creating a selection pressure for the whole bacterial ecosystem. And what's the bacterial ecosystem? The entire planet, because there's bacteria everywhere, and they travel from farm environments to hospitals to communities and back and forth.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions, and then we can stay around afterwards. Are there questions for other speakers?
Obviously, two very good points and good questions. In terms of the surveillance for MRSA, I am not aware of the nature of that study and to what extent that's a comprehensive study, to what extent that was focusing on agricultural counties where one would be seeing it kind of in the way that Denmark did, or was that just, you know, an urban hospital? So I really don't know to what extent that information would, you know, completely refute the point or not, except to say that the point is well taken that the MRSA problem is not in the United States primarily a problem of the non-typeable, that it is, you know, that the bulk of it is coming from the hospital types. And the question is, you know, have we really looked to see where this would be coming in and where it's coming into play? In terms of the Denmark example, I may turn to David for a little help with this. The first thing is that we know from the Denmark example that there is a long time course after the cessation of use before it does go away. I'm not sure that the fact that there is, you know, MRSA in pigs in Denmark, you know, which is neighboring all of these places where there's a lot of use and extension, I think that it does say that if we did phase out antibiotics that we would not expect to see an immediate removal of the problem. But I don't think that that's an argument to say that we should continue antibiotics and to continue to generate additional reservoirs and multi-resistance. I just don't think that the continued existence of the problem, you know, in the ban is a reason that we should continue to, you know, put this kind of ecological pressure on the system. That's the debate. But I think that the point is well taken that the ban is not a magic bullet that will remove the problem that we've created. Thanks.
Okay, last question. Can you talk a little louder too?
I'm not clear whether you're talking about U.S. exports or exports to the U.S. Well, I think we're in the very early stages of understanding some of the trade-offs, particularly with, you know, we're in a global food system. There's a lot of movement back and forth. But one can't immediately assume, as one of the talks yesterday pointed out, that just because something's shipped, that it's higher in fossil fuel use over the life cycle than a particular item that's produced domestically or local. It's all about the nuances. You know, how is that item produced? Is the shipped item produced organically or in a very sustainable environment and then shipped efficiently by boat or by rail, you know, and how do you compare that with a regionally produced item that's not produced terribly sustainably and then a ship by truck? You know, we don't have a lot of that data yet, and I don't think we have the tools yet to really, in a sophisticated way, look at those trade-offs. But that's where I think people are going to be going. So you're asking a really important question that I hope we can answer in 2 or 3 or 5 years.
I want to really thank everybody. Oh, do you really need to? Okay. Thanks, great point. I want to really thank everybody for coming and for a very vibrant discussion and some terrific speakers. I have 3 quick things to say. One is that there's evaluation forms in the back, and we would really appreciate if you would fill them in. 2 is a reminder for those who weren't here in the beginning that we have a group that works together on food and environment issues within APHA, and we'd love your participation. Come talk to us. Number 3, I also want to announce we at the Center for a Livable Future have launched a Public Health and Agriculture Gateway, which is an online resource for all kinds of information about public health and agriculture. And there's wallet cards about it on the environment and nutrition section tables in the exhibit hall, or you can talk to me. Thank you. I don't know if I could have cued you differently when you were asking for time.
Hi. My name is Jennifer.
Hi.
And I'd like to get involved in
Yay.
The environment and food thing that you just mentioned. So how do you do that?
Okay, great, good. Well, I don't know if you've heard about our joint social tonight, but we have a joint social that's going on in the Wine and Culinary Center across the street with local and organic foods, and it's just like a networking thing, and then after dinner we're going to go out, if either of you are still around, I mean for dinner afterwards, and just kind of talk about the next year, and then if you can't go to that, we're going to be having conference calls over the course of the year where we organize and plan and do stuff. So if you give me your email, I can make sure you're on the list, and if you are just in coming, then I'll take your name. Okay, did I don't know if I have a flyer, but it's 6:30 p.m., and it's called the San Diego Wine and Culinary Center, and it's literally, if you're in the convention center and you walk across those train tracks, you're there, so, yeah, and it's 6:30 to 8 p.m., and it's RSVP only, so if you give me your name, then I'll tell. We're technically overbooked, but for people that want to get active in the group, we can make an exception, so that's great. Thank you. Terrific. Good. Thank you.
I don't know yet.
Okay. So we'll put you on the email list. That'd be great. Good. Good to meet you. DC Department of Health.
I'm not there anymore.
Oh. Oh, I see. Okay.
But I was. And then I said, maybe I'll try and go back to my room and copy this down. But then I said, maybe you would lead everybody anyway. So you'll be our tour guide? Good. Okay. Okay, cool. I guess, yeah, if we can get there an hour early, that'd be good. Cool. Hi. Hello. Fantastic. Great. Did you hear about our joint social event tonight?
Okay. So, because I was saying we're going to go out tonight afterwards, and then we'll have an email list. Let me just write down, or do you have a card? Or
I need to write what all these things are.
Talk like a pirate today.
That's too bad.
I'll swab the decks with you.
I still have